My plan today for this morning is to talk about some things that I lectured on at MIT at our retreat for theory graduate students a few years ago. And it was a sort of a three-hour mini course over a few days that I have tried to slice to bits and collect together and condense into the 1 hour that we're planning for today. So hopefully that will go off fairly well. But just to give you a general outline of what I want to touch on, I just briefly want to mention, to start with, some things from non-equilibrium thinking in StatMech that many, if not all of us, will be familiar with, and then start focusing in on some more recent results of the last 10 to 20 years that are a bit more niche and maybe some people haven't seen before. If they've heard of them, they may not have studied their derivation or their origin. So we can try to make their origin clear, and then try to point a way forward to what we can maybe now do or think about or approach with this kind of thinking that maybe didn't seem like it was so accessible before. And I'm going to be talking entirely in classical terms. I did have to study quantum mechanics at some point. Because I'm a biophysicist, I don't start out by thinking in quantum mechanical terms. It may prove to be the case that we eventually need to think quantum mechanically in order to get a lot of things that we're trying to understand in biophysics. I'm starting off with doing something easier and hoping that we can get some traction there first. But I think nonetheless that, you know, hopefully a lot of the intuitions that come out of this discussion will fairly easily and readily extend in directions that are maybe very different than biophysical ones. We're just going to be talking about phase space, volume, and entropy, and likelihood of things happening in systems with many degrees of freedom, and things that obey Newton's laws, or more importantly, things that have time reversal symmetry, obey Liouville's theorem. So, you know, that maps to unitarity in the quantum mechanical case. So a lot of this hopefully is going to feel generally relevant to people and maybe will be stimulating to how they think about entropy and what it can help us understand about complicated systems. So, to start off with, where do I want to begin? So this is the slicing something longer to bits and putting it back together again, which hopefully will work out all right. So the first thing I think we should talk about are just a few basic results that we have seen before, probably in some discussion. You know, it's always the last 2 weeks of some graduate course in StatMech, we start doing non-equilibrium stuff, and everyone's already getting a little bit sleepy, and people sort of say, "All right, here's the fluctuation dissipation theorem, now have a good summer." Now it may not be the case that that's been people's exposure to this subject in the past, but it certainly felt like it was mine for a good part of my physics education. And so it was sort of a pleasure to rediscover some of these subjects and see their connections to some more general and more recent kind of things that people have been saying. So where do we start off? First of all, I think it's nice to just remind ourselves of what we mean when we say that Newton's laws and, let's say, Hamiltonian dynamics in general have something we call time reversal symmetry. So if I write down a Hamiltonian for a system, a classical Hamiltonian, where it's going to evolve over time according to Hamilton's equations. So in general, I have some collection of degrees of freedom, qi, pi, and now they're going to obey Hamilton's equations, which I write this way, which is just a fancy way of writing down Newton's laws. And in principle, this function h could be a function of these coordinates, pi, qi, and maybe also explicitly of time. It doesn't have to be, but it could be that we are time-varying some parameter in this Hamiltonian in some way. So that would be a way we would model, for example, an external field that we're applying to the system. So drawing the system like this, we have a bunch of particles, and they're going to be flying around. But we can also draw it in sort of a phase plane description, where I have my p and q coordinates, and I'm starting at some particular subvolume in this phase space at some particular location. And according to Hamilton's equations, now what's going to happen is I'm going to evolve over time through this phase space and end up somewhere else. And what do we mean when we say that there's a time reversal symmetry to these equations of motion, and why is that interesting? It's just a very simple intuition, which is that if I start here at time zero and I'm going this way, then I can follow this track through phase space and end up over here. But if I momentum reverse my state, which really involves going to some new place in the phase space, right? Because this corresponds to a certain value of momentum and a certain value of position. But if I want to do a momentum reversal, now what I have to do is change my momentum while keeping my position fixed. I'm not going to draw that very well, but so imagine that this is the p goes to minus p mapping from this point in phase space. And then now I'm going to go back along some other track to some other momentum reversed state that maps back to this one. And what it's basically telling us is just that if I throw something up in the air, I can also start at the top and reverse the velocity, or rather, since when it gets to the top, maybe it has no velocity, it'll fall back down. It'll have the same velocity when it gets back down as I might have given it when it flies up in the air. Very basic, simple idea that you can always run one way or the other way along one of these tracks in phase space, and you just have to flip the momentum around in order to do that. That is generally going to be the case as long as there is no time dependence in our Hamiltonian, or if we have some special time symmetric variation in our explicit time dependence in the Hamiltonian. It stops being the case in general if we are doing some arbitrary time varying field. So for a moment, let's just specialize to the case where we don't have this time dependence. Now the question is, what are the interesting consequences of this symmetry for statistical mechanics? And the other thing that we actually need to complete the argument that we want to make is something called Liouville's theorem, which, since I'm compressing things a little bit, I won't prove, but many of us have seen this before, and so hopefully it will be pretty familiar. Liouville's theorem is just telling us that if I write an integration measure for my coordinates at time zero, that when I do the Jacobian for this on a change of variables, looking now, it's taking this phase space volume and mapping it forward to another point in time, this little tiny volume may actually, by my dynamics, get all extruded and spread out over phase space in this complicated, messy balloon shape. But if I actually look at the volume, it's not going to change. And that is just a consequence of the fact that we are obeying Hamilton's equations. We can show that this will be the case. And we can do these changes of variables when we do calculations, and there's no problem with that. It's kind of a, on the one hand, Liouville's theorem, when we emphasize it like it's something we shouldn't have realized before, it's a little bit funny because, of course, we have the idea that you start in one arrangement of things, it would be weird to somehow end up in more than one arrangement in the future. So in a sense, it's almost kind of like saying, if I start in one state, I have to end up in one state as well. But when we have continuous degrees of freedom, obviously we have to be more careful, because I could write down a system of first order differential equations where I don't preserve volume in this phase space. So it might be the case that any individual phase space point always maps to just one other phase space point, but it could be that I'm stretching or extruding the volume around it. Hamiltonian dynamics doesn't have that property. And so there is a sense in which the number of states that we have over here maps to the same number of states that we have over here, the same phase space volume. So now, what's going to be the main interesting consequence of this? Well, there are many interesting consequences. The one I want to focus on, which will be one that we've probably heard of before, is that this means that there's a very interesting property of the system when we reach thermal equilibrium. So thermal equilibrium in this microcanonical sense is the idea that if we have some kind of assumption of molecular chaos in the way we explore this phase space, we start at some arbitrary location of the phase space, we wait a long time, we wander around at constant energy, and I'm only making these lines cross each other because we're projecting in two dimensions. Someone yelled at me once when I was giving a talk, so I have to make that statement. So we don't have to worry about the initial conditions crossing each other or anything, but I'm going to wander around and end up in some other place. And if I wait long enough, I should be nowhere in particular in this phase space. And it's as though on this surface of fixed energy, H of QP equals E, I just threw a dart at this target and it landed in no particular place, and that's where I end up. So that's the microcanonical idea of equilibrium, that we're nowhere in particular in the internal phase space of this closed system. And then usually the next argument we make is that if we want to make some macroscopic measurement, we coarse grain our phase space over different regions that have different possible values of that, and we find there's one very big volume for one particular value, and that's our equilibrium measurement. Some of this is presumably very familiar to a lot of us who've studied StatMech before. So now, what do I say about the property of this equilibrium state? What's interesting is that because of this time reversal symmetry, and because of Liouville's theorem, which tells me that at one time horizon or another one, I can count my states the same, it should be the case that a particular property holds in the thermal equilibrium state, which is called detailed balance. And what detailed balance amounts to is essentially almost a restatement of what I've already told you, that suppose there is some subset of states in this internal phase space, I shouldn't rush through this. This is a whole closed system. But now what I want to do is I want to think about this thing as being broken into two pieces. So one of them is going to be the system that I'm actually interested in, and then there's a bunch of degrees of freedom in these P's and Q's that I'm less interested in, and I'm going to call the bath. This is how we make progress in StatMech. We need to not have to think about the whole universe, but we want to think about just the piece of it that we're interested in, and we have to have some sort of simplified model for the rest of it. So here we've been talking about closed system microcanonical formulation, but now we want to move in the direction of thinking in canonical terms. And so what we'll say is that there's a bath with some temperature that is defined in the usual way, where we count states and arrangements in the bath. We take a derivative with respect to energy that gives us an inverse temperature. And we're interested in now the question of going back and forth between two arrangements. So suppose I start with my system in some microstate that I would call I. So I specifies some, maybe I shouldn't call it I, I should call it X, let's say. So X specifies some particular choice of the momentum and position coordinates for the system. And my bath is in no particular state. I would just randomly select a bath microstate. And then I want to think about a transition over to the system being in some state Y, where I still have this bath that it's in contact with it and is interacting with the degrees of freedom in my system. And I can think about now this as a stochastic process in a sense. So the scenario is I start with the system in state X, and then I initialize it in contact with a randomly selected heat bath microstate. Because what makes heat baths is that we don't want to think about the details of what's going on in them. We consider their initial conditions to be drawn randomly from the deck of available configurations. Yeah?
So is this partition in the partition in space, or is the partition in some real space?
So the partition is always going to be determined in reality by your experimental setup. So you're going to need to make an argument for why there's some large number of rapidly relaxing, weakly coupled degrees of freedom that have some temperature and that basically don't change any of their measurable physical properties when you put a little energy in them. So that could be the air around you or some liquid that's coupled to the degrees of freedom that you're interested in. But yeah, it's definitely not, I'm drawing this picture this way, this is not in any geometric sense, a separate volume in phase space or anything like that. I'm just collecting degrees of freedom that we're interested in over here and reminding us that there's a sense in which set theoretically we've separated them. So now I can think of this as a stochastic system where after some time tau, let's say, I want to know what is the probability in time tau that given that I started in X, that I end up in Y. So that's a well-defined probabilistic question where I have to be a little more careful and talk about little infinitesimal phase space volumes around X, but it works the same if I just think about it discretely, so let's talk about it discretely. So I start in X, I'm going to wait time tau while it's sitting in contact with a heat bath and ask, what's the probability that it's going to be in Y after that amount of time? And what's interesting is that when we come back to this microcanonical description, we can see a deep truth here, because there is some collection of states here which are in X. And there's also some collection of states here which are in Y. I say collection of states because the reason this has some finite volume is because I have all the different ways I could arrange the bath while putting things in X, and I have all the different ways I could arrange the bath while putting them in Y. And now what we're interested in specifically is the subset of these states that deterministically are going to evolve along trajectories that carry you into Y. So you're going to have this collection, the smaller collection of states there, and it lands in this smaller collection of states over in Y. And what's important here is because of time reversal symmetry, we know that there's some number of microtrajectories for this system that starts over here, lands over there, and that when we time reverse things or flip the momenta around, we should be able to have the same number of trajectories running back from this little subvolume here back into this other volume there. That our counting of states at the beginning and at the end doesn't change, and so we have basically this one tube of trajectories. It's not really one tube of trajectories because we have to do the momentum reversal, but we have this one count of trajectories with a certain set of shapes that start in X and end in Y, or start in momentum reversed Y and end in momentum reversed X. And that means something quite significant, because it means that if I can write this in the following way, that there's some omega sub X goes to Y in time tau, which is equal to the omega of X star is the destination from Y star in time tau, and the count is the same. But we can go back now into thinking about this probability and also a reverse probability, Y star going back to X star, and write the following, that e to the minus beta, the energy of X over Z times pi of X goes to Y is equal to e to the minus beta energy of Y, because energy of Y and Y star is generally the same if our momentum has the usual effect on our energy, the reason this is true is because I'm just breaking things apart into the conditional probability of going from X to Y given that I start in X, and I also have to think about what's the likelihood of being in X when I start in this ensemble of all the different things that could happen at constant energy. So I get my Boltzmann probability for starting in X, and this is going to be the conditional probability of going from there to Y, so that's going to correspond to this count of trajectories, and then the reverse will look the same. Questions about this before I keep going? Okay, good. So I don't mean to belabor something that people have probably seen before, but I think it's nice to start on firm footing before things get a little bit less familiar. So what can we do with this? Well, the standard thing that you see, first of all, is at least in a first StatMech course that I took, or maybe a second one, people talked about, this statement already tells you about what we call a detailed balance property for the thermal equilibrium state, which is telling you that essentially when I'm at thermal equilibrium, I have equal and opposite probability flux connecting X to Y and Y star to X star, and when you're thinking in chemical terms, you don't have to worry about the stars. So it's basically saying that, let's say at chemical equilibrium, A goes to B and B goes to A have equal and opposite currents that counterbalance each other. And so you don't have, for example, cycles running around in circles at thermal equilibrium where A goes to B does not balance B goes to A, but it all sorts out in some larger currents. You don't get these circular currents in phase space at thermal equilibrium because of this time reversal symmetry. And a slightly subtler thing that people say is, oh, well, you can algebraically rearrange this thing and say that pi tau of Y star goes to X star over pi tau of X goes to Y. When you look at this ratio between these two quantities, what you get is e to the minus beta epsilon x minus epsilon y over z, and not over z, sorry. You look at the ratio of these two Boltzmann weights. So the ratio of these two probabilities is equal to the ratio of the Boltzmann weights. And I've been really surprised once I've started trying to write papers about this and have conversations with people at how infrequently people appreciate something that I think is very important about this equation, which is that although it is derived from the detailed balance condition that has to hold at thermal equilibrium, it is not itself something that is only true when there is detailed balance. What do I mean by this? This is a statement we get from time reversal symmetry. And then we rewrite it in this way because we know that in the thermal equilibrium state, we have a Boltzmann distribution and we can break it apart in the following way. But once I write this statement down, this is a statement about the general stochastic dynamics that I should see when I put this system in contact with a heat bath, even if its initial condition is very far from thermal equilibrium. And what I mean by that is very far from a state you would typically see in thermal equilibrium. So I could, you know, have a closed collection of matter in contact with a heat bath, and I could initialize it in a state that is one bacterium sitting in a bunch of food. And the only thing this thing can do in terms of its interaction with a heat bath is exchange heat. It is not, as we usually think about it, in thermal equilibrium because it's starting in a state we would never see in the equilibrium distribution. But it's starting in one particular microstate, a bacterium sitting in food. And over time, what will happen is this will relax the thermal equilibrium, right? Because over time, when you're sitting in contact with a heat bath, your distribution eventually converges on a Boltzmann distribution. So the point is the relaxation process is a very long one because you're very far from equilibrium, far from a state that's typical in equilibrium. So you have one bacterium, then you make two, then you make four, and then they overeat the container, and then they all die, and then they float around and eventually fall apart. And it takes a really long time. But nonetheless, the relaxation process is one that would converge to an equilibrium state that obeyed detailed balance if we look at the forward evolution of the probability distribution under this Markov matrix, let's say, this stochastic propagator. But the point is that there's a lot of very interesting non-equilibrium dynamics if you know what the stochastic propagator is. And what we have is a general statement on of many constraints in microscopic detail on all the matrix elements here. It doesn't tell you what it is, but it tells you many things that it can't be. So that's one point that I think is very important. Another one, though, is that we can also look at this ratio of Boltzmann weights and rewrite it in a way that's highly suggestive. Because in our system as we've described it right now, we don't have any time-varying field. And we just have conservation of energy in our total setup with system plus bath. And so what that means is that if my internal energy of my system changes, then the only thing that could cause that to happen is if there is some exchange of heat with the surrounding heat bath, right? If my internal energy goes up or down, then the energy of the bath is going to go down or up accordingly. And that is what we call the exchange of heat. So what I can do is I can rewrite this as e to the minus beta delta q as we go from, what is it, x to y. Now, why is that significant? I think the reason this is significant is because it means that a very long time ago, and maybe people appreciated this but then stopped teaching it this way, people could have taught me in my first StatMech course that once you know about the idea of detailed balance of thermal equilibrium, you already have immediately a microscopically detailed exact statement of the relationship between irreversibility and entropy production. Why do I say that? Well, what is delta Q divided by the temperature? Because beta is just equal to 1 over T or 1 over KBT if you want to make life more laborious. So I'm taking the heat, I'm dividing by the temperature. That is what we call entropy. We're taking energy, we're putting it in a heat bath. It's the standard definition of what it means to change the entropy of something. You put energy into a heat bath at a certain temperature, congratulations, you've made some entropy. So now, over here, what we're saying is this measures the extent to which statistically, in contact with the bath, I'm more likely to go from x to y than from y to x, or from y star to x star. So I would call this statistical irreversibility, and I would call this entropy production, and we have an exact relationship between them. So everyone always told me that entropy and irreversibility are linked and somehow things are irreversible, then there should somehow be some positive change in entropy. But I somehow managed to, and this may have been my fault more than anyone else's, but I somehow managed to get very far in my education before I understood that actually there is a very straightforward, exact relationship between how irreversible something is and how much entropy has to be generated in the surroundings when it happens. All of this right now only applies when we are not driving the system in any way. So we're talking about a system that would eventually relax the thermal equilibrium. So before we start getting into what happens when we start driving it, I'll stop here and make sure we're all on the same page. So is this clear and sensible to people? Okay, good. I think I've probably already used too much of my time, so I'm going to try to expedite things a little bit. All right, so now that is something that we probably are familiar with from before. Now let's say something that we're maybe less familiar with. So now the new scenario that we want to consider is one where we are going to drive the system, and as a result, we get something that is the generalization of the statement that we've just seen, and it requires a little bit more care in setting it up. So we now think about as the system where we have some time-varying field in our total Hamiltonian that only acts on the, let's say, x system degrees of freedom. So we have h of x sys and some parameter lambda of t that varies in time. And then we also have h of the bath, which is some function of the coordinates x bath. And then there's some little interaction Hamiltonian that we use as a placeholder to remind ourselves that we need to have some exchange of energy between the system and the bath. Hopefully we just ignore it other than by the fact that we allow energy to flow between them. So if we write things in this way, now we want to think about this quantity lambda of t and what effect it's going to have on the dynamics of the system. Liouville's theorem, it turns out, still holds in this case. So we still can do this nice counting of states. But what no longer holds is we no longer have conservation of energy telling us that the change from this state to that state is going to change our internal energy and as a result cause a certain amount of heat dissipation. Now in principle, some things are decoupled. We can do a certain amount of work on the system with this applied field as time goes on. And then that work energy can go to two different places in general. It could go to the bath as dissipated heat, or it could go to changing the internal energy of the system. And where it goes in a particular microscopic realization is going to depend on the particular microtrajectory that we take. So what's true now is that dH total dt is going to be del H total del T plus del H total del PI, PI dot, plus del H total del QI, QI dot. And because of Hamilton's equations, we get rid of that. And it's just going to be the partial derivative of H total with respect to time, which is only going to be the partial derivative of the system Hamiltonian with respect to time, because that's the only thing with an explicit time dependence. And so what that tells us is that if I specify x of t, this whole microtrajectory that my system takes while this process is happening, once I have done that, then the amount of work that I do is fixed. So it could be that there are multiple ways of initializing the bath such that it just so happens that as I drive the system, the system is going to propagate through some series of microstates x of t. But if it does that, then I have exactly pegged the amount of work that I've done. And so now what we can do is we can think about what happens when we make these same kinds of arguments in a scenario where we're driving the system in this way. And what I want to think about now is not just about the probability of going back the way I came and landing in the right place. I want to think about doing the whole microtrajectory. So what I'm going to define is a probability that looks like this. The probability of seeing the whole microtrajectory x of t given that I start in some x of 0 And I also am being driven by the protocol lambda of t. And I look at things after time tau. I have this quantity that I can define. And the way that I'm going to write it in this microcanonical notation is I'm going to take the number of phase space points in the whole system that follow x of t under the drive. So I can still, in my phase space, go to some subset of locations in that phase space where I start with my system in x and my heat bath is in a microstate such that when I drive it, it's going to follow this whole microtrajectory specified for x of t. But if I start over here with a different bath microstate, my x of t is going to be the same, but my bath degrees of freedom will do something different, and I'll land over here in some other surface of states that is the forward mapping of these initial states. And in order to figure out this probability, what I need to do is I need to divide it by all the different ways I could have initialized the system. So this is all the ways that I get my microtrajectory that I'm going to specify. And the number of ways of initializing the system is just the number of ways of arranging the bath, given that you've dedicated a certain amount of energy to putting your system in state x of 0. So it's just going to be omega bath times E minus epsilon of x 0, where E is the total energy that I start with. So just think about this. We start with some energy E, and then we're going to be driven by this time-varying field. We're going to end up always, as long as we follow x of t, we're going to end up on a surface of states E plus W, where W is this functional of x of t. So this is the nice thing we're trying to arrange, is we want all the possible things that happen to carry us forward into states for the system plus bath that have the same total energy, because that will be useful to us. So this is how I write down the probability of seeing my microtrajectory, given that I initialize it in a certain way, which is the number of ways of going there divided by the number of ways of arranging the initial conditions, the number of cards you can draw from the deck in terms of your heat bath microstates. And then what I do is I think about the reverse. So now I have to ask, what is the number of ways of running back along the same microtrajectories that I run forward along in this scenario? And because of Liouville's theorem, I know it's going to be the same number. So formally, I'll write this as the probability, where I put a star on to now refer to the fact that we're going under time-reversed drives and momentum-reversed states. So this is the pair opposite to this one. This is the probability of going along x of t. This is the probability of running back along the time-reversed movie, basically, of what just happened. So one of these things could be, it starts with me standing here in my heat bath holding a hamburger, and the sun's shining on me, and I'm going to eat the hamburger or something like that. And then this is me regurgitating bits of the hamburger, and they all spontaneously self-assemble back together in my mouth and come back into my hand as a complete hamburger. And more importantly, it's not all the ways that would look like that to us. It's one particular set of microscopic rearrangements that would look like that. That's very important. So we don't notice which microstate anything is in all the time. We're always looking at more coarse-grained observables. But this is the probability of one particular microscopic reversal of that. And when I write down what this thing is going to be, it's going to be this count of microtrajectories that run in the reverse direction. But of course, and then we're going to divide this by, the number of ways of initializing the system for the reverse run. So now we have to pick all the different ways we could arrange this E plus W heat bath and specify the energy of our x of t or x star, x of tau or x star of tau. But the point here, and the important thing, is that this quantity is going to be equal to this one because of Liouville's theorem. It is going to be the case that omega of x of t is equal to omega star of x star of tau minus t. And the reason that that's useful is because that means when I look at the ratio of this probability to that one, let's call this, so that I can not have to write it all out again, pi reverse. And let's call this pi forward. when I look at the ratio of pi reverse over pi forward, this is going to divide out with this because they're the same because of Liouville's theorem. And then, of course, the nice thing is that as a result, I get the ratio of two countings of states in the bath. And really what makes a heat bath is that I have omega bath in log form is going to obey this relation, that the temperature of the bath is set by this behavior. So in other words, bath counting of microstates just has a simple exponential behavior in the energy in the bath. So let's see if I can get this right. I'm going to put reverse on the top. And so when I put reverse on the top, that's going to mean that it is E minus epsilon x zero on the top here, and then E plus W minus epsilon x of tau on the bottom. And so now I just want to look at the ratio of these two quantities, which I get from the fact that they just have to each behave exponentially in their arguments. And so this is going to give me E to the minus beta. And now I get what? W plus epsilon x zero minus epsilon x of tau. The factors of E divide out. It doesn't matter what our total energy of the system is to begin with. What we care about is the work that we did and how much of it went to the internal energy change of the system. Or putting this another way, this is E to the minus beta times Q of x of t. That there is some heat dissipated in the bath along the forward direction, and that is still exactly equal to the statistical reversibility now with paired microtrajectories of the forward driven scenario. So I can talk about the likelihood of my continuing to eat the hamburger all the way to the end in a particular way, and I can talk about the likelihood of seeing the reverse event while in contact with the same heat bath and being driven by a time reversed version of the same applied field. And to the extent that one of these movies is much, much more likely to run forward than in the reverse direction, that is quantified by the amount of heat that's exhausted into the surrounding bath in the forward direction. So this is something that was not derived this way by Gavin Crookes, but was formally shown in a Markov model in, I think, 99 in PRE. It's a nice paper. And I think at the time, this equation was not what was emphasized as the important result of that paper. There's sort of consequences of it you can derive that I think we're more focused on. I think this is the really important thing. And I'm not the only one who has said that since. What's really important here is that you maintain an exact relationship between statistical irreversibility and entropy production or dissipation in the surroundings as a result of essentially time reversal symmetry, Liouville's theorem, these things that you can rely on in the general assumptions you make about the dynamics of your system. So make of this what you will right now. It seems to be just a formal statement, but now the question is, what can we do with it? What is interesting about it? And to carry things forward next, the first observation we just need to make is that in order to map this back to the statement that we made previously, where we were just thinking about starting states and ending states, you first want to think about integrating over all the internal steps here. Like if I just want to think about I start in X and I end up in Y, I don't want to worry about all the different ways I could get from X to Y. Then I have to integrate this density over all the different ways I could do it. And if I do that, then what I get is something that will look just like what we already wrote down, except that I have to draw some new brackets in. So the idea now is that pi star of y star to x star in time tau over pi x to y in time tau. So we're doing the time reversal of the field on the top. This thing, we're still going to have e to the minus beta q as you go from x to y. But now we have to average over all the different weightings of probabilities of ways of getting from x to y. So this is the thing. Once you have driven systems in contact with a heat bath, every time I draw a piece of chalk along the chalkboard, there's some different amount of heat that's exhausted in the surroundings. Even if I apply exactly the same field and I am using exactly the same starting arrangement, but what's different is the initial state of the heat bath, which causes there to be stochasticity in the exact amount of heat that's dissipated. And so, maybe chalk's a bad example because I leave some chalk on the chalkboard, but if I ignore that issue for a second, it's always true that I have a different micro trajectory. In general, it's going to be true that I have a different micro trajectory every time I do this. The starting state and the end state can be the same. And I think that's what we're trying to focus on now, is don't think about all the ways of getting from X to Y. You want to just average over them. What you're generally doing is you're starting with some observation. You're going to make some other observation in the future. You want to think about the probability of getting from A to B. And this is how we wrote it down before. When we didn't have a drive, conservation of energy guaranteed for us that the heat was the same every time, because the difference in energy of the starting and ending states determines that. Now that we have a drive, we have to worry about the heat bath microstate. So we have a statistical distribution of heats for this process, and we have to average this exponential over them in order to get this result. But if we do that, this is still exact, and it's a statement of the exact microscopically detailed relationship between statistical irreversibility and entropy production in a general scenario for an arbitrary time-varying drive in contact with a heat bath. So now we can talk in a second about what various consequences of this are, which are going to be interesting and refer to things that are happening more recently in the field. But I should stop here because I just laid a lot on you. So any questions about this? Okay. Oh, sorry. Right. So the only thing I did to get from there, sorry, I leaped over this, is I take this and I do a path integral where I say I want to integrate over all the internal coordinates x of t and average this quantity e to the minus beta q over pi forward. Then I have to normalize. So when I do this, I can show, because of this relationship, I basically use this to flip around the pi forward. So I'm doing an integral over the reverse probabilities on top, an integral over the forward probabilities on the bottom, and I recover this relationship. But what I've done then is I've shown that that ratio is equal to the average over forward probabilities of e to minus beta q. Yeah, exactly. So I'm trying to take it back to the analogy with what we usually see when we study detailed balance. And so there are various things that you could say about this quantity. One thing that we can do fairly easily from here is derive something called the Yerzinski relation, which talks about a specific scenario where we initialize our system in thermal equilibrium. So we start with our system, we put it in contact with the heat bath. So initially it's in thermal equilibrium. It starts with a probability distribution over states given by the Boltzmann distribution. And then we do our time-varying lambda of t procedure. And what we do is we measure the work that we do over repeated experiments. So I could do this experiment over and over and over again. I equilibrate my system. I do some time-varying field. Every time I do a different amount of work, I collect together all the data, and I make a distribution, P of W, which could look however it wants to look. And now, you know, when I land over here, my system is in some new distribution over states, and who the heck knows what it is. In general, it's going to be some non-equilibrium distribution, because I was just, over a finite period of time, applying a time-varying field to an equilibrated system. But what's interesting, what Yerzynski was able to show in 97, the seminal paper is PRL 97, and it's Yerzynski, is that if you now take this distribution, P of W, and you average e to the minus beta W over it, so you're doing a weighted average of the exponential of the work, that this quantity has a special property, which is that it is equal to e to the minus beta delta F equilibrium between lambda of tau and lambda of zero. So the idea here is that my time-varying field starts at some one value, lambda of zero, it ends at some other value, lambda of tau. And if I did this infinitely slowly, I'd just be doing the equilibrium work as I shift some control parameter in my Hamiltonian, and my change in free energy is equal to my work. We know that when we do this in a finite amount of time, we generally do a different amount of work every time, but also, in general, on average, we do more work than we would do if we were doing the quasi-static process and staying close to equilibrium. But the crazy thing that really shocked everyone was that if you sum up the works in the right way, you recover the equilibrium free energy difference. And that seems really marvelous because it's sort of, you know, how does the system know that it's supposed to obey this rule when you collect together all the data? You can recover the equilibrium result from the non-equilibrium experiments. With this Crookes-type result, we're actually in a good position to show that the Yerzynski result follows fairly, I don't want to say trivially, but it's very easy to see where it comes from. Because, and I mean, the direction I actually came to all this subject matter in was I learned about the Yerzynski thing first, and I was sort of puzzling over why it was true, because it seemed kind of weird that it all collects together. And then the answer turns out to be, oh, well, of course, there's a microscopically detailed relation that every microtransition has to obey. And so the fact that they do this is going to be the result of something that is a tighter constraint on every single experiment that you could do. But if we just want to write this out so we can see where it comes from, averaging the work as I go from microstate I to microstate j is going to be the heat that I exhaust plus the energy at time tau of state j minus the energy at time zero of state I. That's the work that I do. This is just a statement of conservation of energy. And so if I integrate over state I and state j, my starting distribution is a Boltzmann distribution at the initial time. So I have z0 and e to the minus beta epsilon I at time zero. I'm going to write pi of I to j in time tau, and then I do e to the minus beta delta epsilon, and I have to also multiply by this average over all the different ways of dissipating heat in the surroundings. So this is just a formal statement of what this average amounts to when we average over every stochastic event of going from I to j and weight by the probability of it happening, and then accordingly talk about all the different ways that we could generate heat as we do that. And so the same thing as we talked about before essentially works now, where we look at the average of an exponential of a heat, and we can use that to flip a forward probability into a reverse probability. And what makes this simple here is that, just to compactify this a little bit, this thing is going to flip I to j. So I'm going to turn this into pi j to I. And you can already see that since I'm integrating over I, that's very attractive because the probability of going somewhere is always one. So this is going to have the chance of dropping out very nicely. The other thing that has to happen is this e to the minus beta delta E, this delta E thing up here, what's going to happen is the EI0 here cancels that, and I just get back an EJ tau. So I get an integral over DI of pi J to I, which is just one, and then an integral over DJ of e to the minus beta epsilon tau J divided by Z0. And what's the integral over states of all the Boltzmann weights? It's just going to be z tau. So I get z tau over z0, and the ratio of these two partition functions is the same thing as this equilibrium free energy difference exponentiated. So that's where it comes from. And it's just a consequence, again, of this microscopically detailed relationship between irreversibility and entropy production in the surroundings. What is significant about this? Well, first of all, one of the things that it's nice to appreciate about the Ursinski result is that without suggesting itself as such, it is the generalization of the fluctuation dissipation theorem for arbitrary distance from equilibrium. So what we're used to in the fluctuation dissipation theorem is that I have some time-varying field, I'm close to equilibrium, I'm in the linear response regime, and so what I get back is that some kind of one-point average of some work or response susceptibility kind of thing that I calculate is going to be expressible in terms of some two-point correlation function, some average over the equilibrium ensemble of some pair of things. How does it end up looking like that in this case? Well, first of all, let's define the dissipated work as the work that we do minus the equilibrium free energy difference. So this is the extra work that we do in a given experiment, given that we know what the equilibrium free energy difference should be, and now we can rewrite the Ursinski result as the average of the dissipated work is always equal to one, and we do it in this exponentially weighted way. I'm just taking the equilibrium free energy difference over here and bringing it into the exponential over there. Pretty simple. So why is that interesting? Well, because if I now write minus the log of e to the minus beta WD, that's equal to zero. That's kind of a funny thing to do at first. I can even go like this, minus one over beta the log of that, because I know where I'm going. I'm just taking the log of one and getting zero. Why is that interesting? Because this is a cumulant generating function that I can do a Taylor expansion in small beta or about high temperature. And what I get then is that this is equal to the average of WD minus the variance of WD divided by 2 times beta plus dot, 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 higher order cumulants, which is still equal to 0. So in the linear response regime, it turns out the work distribution has to be Gaussian. And in that case, all your other cumulants go away. And what you get is that your average dissipated work has a fixed relationship to the variance, which is your fluctuations. So that's the normal fluctuation dissipation theorem that we know. And the fact that this remains true, even when you're driving arbitrarily far from equilibrium, just means that you have these higher order cumulants that have to be accounted for in the fluctuations in the right quantitative way. But it still remains the case that the average of WD is equal to a bunch of stuff accounting for your fluctuations summed up in the appropriate way. So this is one statement of fluctuation dissipation arbitrarily far from equilibrium, and we get it from the same things that we would get the fluctuation dissipation theorem from originally, time reversibility, Liouville's theorem, those kinds of things. So it turns out that this statement, the Ursinski result, and also this one, this Crookes result, are examples of what people now call fluctuation theorems, which are different kinds of averages of exponentials that you can derive arbitrarily far from equilibrium that tell us things about the statistics of entropy production in various stochastic realizations of a driven process where you have some time-varying field or some mechanisms of entropy production in the surroundings, and you're trying to make statements about the likelihood of things happening. And up until this point, what I've mainly done is just motivate for you some things that have been in the literature now for 10 years or so, and they've been kind of incubating in the bloodstream. And I think there are some incredibly interesting things one can say as consequences of these. I can start talking a little bit about that now if I can run slightly past the hour. And since I don't want to keep you all here as a captive audience, I can also tell you that I plan to talk about it even more in my talk this afternoon. But before I keep going, I'll stop here and make sure we're on the same page again. Are there other questions?
Yeah. You were the parity of non-equilibrium phenomena automatically included. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the time scales is very, very different, completely mm-hmm. different. So how does that affect the research?
So
if you look at averages versus fluctuation,
uh-huh.
it could be.
Yes, all right, good. So that gives me an opportunity to talk about one of the most important things to say about this whole fluctuation theorem business, which is that there's something very worrying about averaging exponentials. And so the issue here is that on a given time scale, there are some events which are extremely rare statistically. So to give a biological example, there in a cell, let's say, are two ways of making a protein. One way is to use ribosomes to synthesize the protein, and you expend some energy to do that and do some entropy production. That's the usual way cells do that. There's also a way of making proteins that doesn't happen because it's very unlikely, which is you take the thing you usually use to rip proteins apart, which is called the proteasome, and you accidentally run it backwards because of a thermal fluctuation. You never ever see that, right? It's inconceivably unlikely that a thermal fluctuation would produce that result, even down on the molecular scale. However, if that did happen, there would be a lot of negative entropy production. And the problem with negative entropy production here is that if you're averaging e to the minus beta delta q, if delta q is negative, you have this enormous upweighting of the importance of that term. Or thinking of it in terms of work, again, most of the time we dissipate a positive amount of work. In fact, because of the inequalities of Jensen, where you know that e to the x is always greater than or equal to 1 plus x for a real x, what this implies is that the average of the dissipated work must be greater than or equal to 0. So that's the nice no free lunch kind of statement in thermodynamics, that we always, on average, end up dissipating more in the surroundings when we do something in finite time. But in a given experiment, you could have a rare event where you get some free energy, you get some energy that you didn't expect to get, some work done on you from your system because of a thermal fluctuation, where essentially the bath is donating to you. And those things do not matter very often in the experimental observation on average, but they do matter sometimes to the values of these quantities. So that's a significant concern. And what it, I think one of the effects it had was that it drove the science surrounding the Yarzynski result initially in the direction of looking at single molecule systems. Because if you're wiggling an applied field on, say, a protein in an atomic trap, then the amount of work that you're doing or the free energy changes are on the order of KT or slightly bigger. So you have a chance of sampling the tails of this distribution enough that even the rare events can properly be accounted for, and you can try to use the non-equilibrium experiments to measure the equilibrium free energy differences. There is a bigger issue if you're going to try to do that with me eating a hamburger, right? Because now the amounts of dissipation are so much bigger than KT that it seems like you're never going to cover the relevant rare events. And as an aside, as long as I'm talking about it, I'll mention that there's sort of a funny story in the history of science here having to do with this issue of measuring equilibrium free energy differences, where because people know what free energy is and they like it so much and they're so interested in it, I think that the first thing that people were interested in doing with this stuff is measuring equilibrium free energies, which is kind of funny because, I don't know, I mean, I think non-equilibrium systems are very interesting, and we shouldn't necessarily be trying to always take things back to equilibrium in some sense. Although this is a very good first test to do with the result. The other thing is, which is sort of a sad story or an interesting one, is that a lot of this stuff in some form was kind of published in the Soviet Union in the 70s. But the fellows who did this by the names of Bochkov and Kuzovlev did this proof of this Yarzynski type relation in the case where the applied field goes back to lambda zero at the end. And the problem with that is that then the equilibrium free energy difference is zero, so they just got that this thing is equal to one. And when you prove something is equal to one, it just doesn't pop in the same way because lots of things are equal to one. And I think people didn't really notice the more fundamental consequences of this. But when you do it where the applied field is something different at the end, you can say, we can use this to connect it to equilibrium free energies. Then suddenly people kind of realized, wow, there's real information about equilibrium, very far from equilibrium. And that got people really thinking in a different direction. So I think sometimes, success in science is very genuinely partly about recognizing the value of what you've done. And so, although I feel bad for them, Bochkov and Kuzovlev might be compared to someone who bought a Picasso at a yard sale for $1 and then sold it for $10, which, you know, hopefully one can avoid doing with one's scientific discoveries. But in any case, that was too much of an aside. Now the question is, how do we deal with this issue of the statistics of these exponential weightings? And this is something where I would say I'll just try to give a very brief teaser for where this goes moving forward, and you'll hear about more in the talk this afternoon. What I think is interesting about these results is that you can take this thing, the microscopically detailed relationship between entropy production and irreversibility, and you can build it up into an arbitrary macroscopic statement, which is that I can have some arbitrary macro state with some initial distribution over some arrangement one, and then I can talk about the probability of going from one to two, and one and two can be arbitrarily constructed to be whatever criterion I want to apply. I'm just going to label microstates with one and with two in some disjoint sets and think about the probability of ending up over here in two. So this is the probability of landing in two given that you started in one with some initial non-equilibrium distribution. And this thing is the probability over microstates J in two given that you started in one and then landed in two after some finite time. And if you construct the scenario in this way, it is still the case that there is a well-defined sense in which you can say that the irreversibility, now in terms of macroscopic things you can actually measure, still is going to have this relationship to entropy production. And now it's total entropy production because we have to worry about the difference in phase space volume between these two macrostates. And it seems like this is useless because why do we want to think about macrostates if everything is always bigger than KT and we can't sample the rare events? This tau could be 10 seconds or a billion years, and in either case, there are going to be things that are likely to happen in that time and other things that are unlikely to happen in that time that may kill us. But what we now can do is rearrange this by considering a scenario where I have a starting state, another starting state, another ending state, and an ending state, and I want to compare the likelihood of these two different outcomes under some arbitrary applied field. And I can just algebraically flip this out and heuristically break it apart and write things in this way, that I'm going to compare after a finite time the likelihood of landing in two given that I start in one, or the likelihood of landing in three given that I start in one. So I have two different things that could happen given some starting state, and I evolve under finite time after I evolve for a finite time under the influence of a particular time varying field. And you can break this apart essentially into three pieces. One is going to be the difference in internal entropy between two and three. It's easier to hit a big target in phase space than a small target in phase space. So all things being equal, you still have an effect from internal entropy. But then you also have this kinetic term. And what this is telling you is that all things being equal, it is easier to come back from somewhere. Sorry, it is easier to go somewhere if it is easier to come back from there in the same amount of time. So that's just saying if you lower a barrier, a kinetic barrier to something, things get faster in both directions. On any given time horizon, so this speaks back to the question about time scales. On any given time horizon, there are going to be things that are easier to make happen just because they are kinetically more immediately accessible to the way you started out in your system. And so depending on whether tau here is 10 seconds or a billion years, different ending states are going to have more or less a likelihood of being seen because of the typical ways in which your system fluctuates away from its starting state. And then the last thing is going to be this average of bath entropy production over the two different possible ensembles of trajectories you could take. You could go from one to two, or you could go from one to three. So why is it interesting to write things this way? Well, first of all, this is what I would call the generalization of Helmholtz free energy for an arbitrarily driven finite time process with an arbitrary starting condition. You're trying to compare likelihoods of different things appearing in your future probability distribution given a certain starting arrangement. And the different factors that affect it are going to be the usual internal entropy one, the kinetic one, and then this exponential average of bath entropy production, which seems to still be troubled by the same issue with rare events. But there is at least, I can do it a sort of a trick that may seem like sleight of hand and turn two problems into one here, and then whether we can get rid of the last problem, I probably need a little bit more time for. So maybe that will become clearer this afternoon. But basically, here's what I want to say. There are two criticisms you could make of this that say it's useless. One of them is what we've already talked about, rare events in entropy production killing us, right? That there are things that we're never going to measure, we can't compute the likelihood of, and they may dominate these exponential averages. There's another thing here which is even more troubling, which is that I'm claiming to you somehow that I have this expression now where presumably it's going to tell me about relative likelihoods of outcomes in this stochastic process. But if you look over here, why would you ever think it's easier to know the probability of coming back from somewhere than the probability of going there? In general, that's not going to be the case, right? This is also just some consequence of all the details of your particular stochastic model for your system. So all you're saying is, if I can simulate every possible microtrajectory of the system, here's a statement of conservation of energy and probability that has to be obeyed. But in practice, to know these things exactly, I would need to know things equally difficult to know exactly. So what I do is I first of all can use this term as kind of like a black hole and turn two problems into one. What I mean by this is the following. I can at least say that I don't actually have to integrate over all possible internal pieces of the microtrajectory that carry me from my starting state to my ending state. So when I wrote this down here, I said, these are all the different possible ways of getting from some starting state to some ending state, the likely ones and also the freakishly unlikely ones. But what I can do is I can constrain this to a, let's say, likely forward tube in phase space of possible ways of getting from my starting state to my ending state. So there's some ways of getting from one to two that are very likely, relatively speaking, and others that are freakishly unlikely. For example, I could have a bacterium and it's sitting in food, and the likely way of getting two bacteria from one is that the bacterium grows and divides. An unlikely way is the spontaneous self-assembly of another bacterium sitting next to it in the medium, both of which are allowed and both of which have some finite probability in this formal description. One is a likely way of things happening, another is an unlikely way of things happening. What's that?
You're breaking your cardicity by hand. You're focusing on some region in phase space.
Right. So you decide, you know, as the experimenter, you decide on what the particular observations are that are, you're likely to make based on your empirical observation. And then that doesn't change this quantity almost at all, because by definition, we're looking at the events that dominate the forward probability current. It also doesn't change this quantity because this is about starting and ending states. And it's changes both of these quantities in ways that are actually just beneficial, because now I'm only averaging exponential of entropy production over events that I actually can measure. So I don't have to worry about freak rare events that have nothing to do with observable physics. What it changes about this quantity is that instead of knowing the probability of getting from 2 to 1 by any possible way, I now am looking at the probability of getting from 2 to 1 by things that look like a movie reverse of something that was likely in the forward direction. So that may not be any easier to know, but I've at least turned two terms that may be useless to me into one term that may be useless to me. And the last step, which I will only sketch briefly, but hopefully I can make the argument a little bit more convincingly when I give my talk this afternoon, or at least present empirical data that suggests that this hand waving that I'm about to do might be sensible, is that you don't need to know this in order to look for the effect of this term on the whole surface of possible likely outcomes for your driven stochastic scenario. So say I'm doing an experiment where I start in this arrangement, which is say primordial soup, and then I wait a billion years and I have like a plant here or something like that. Or I could do something else in 10 seconds, it doesn't matter. Whatever kind of experiment I'm doing, I make some observation, and presumably the thing that I observed was pretty likely, because otherwise I wouldn't have seen it. And you can't do the comparison of the thing you observed to every other thing that could happen. But what you can do is say, how do I now compare this thing to other things that happen to have the same entropy and the same reversal probability? I don't know what that reversal probability is. So I observe a plant. I don't know what the likelihood of a plant running backwards into where it came from is. But whatever that likelihood is, there are other ways of arranging the same matter that happen to live on that same surface of reversal probability. And if I have a many particle system and I have a huge combinatorial space of components that can have a tremendous diversity of mechanical response properties, then the nice thing is that even on this surface of just the ways of arranging things so that they have the same reversal probability, I still should have a huge amount of diversity in properties on that surface. And now what that tells me is that when I see a likely outcome of this process, I should be looking at something that looks like it was optimized over this quantity on some diverse set that I don't know. So the way I've realized I can put this is that when we look at a bat, let's say, we can tell that it's good at flying. And what we mean by that is not that we can tell it's the best possible flyer that we could make out of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, et cetera, but that it's a lot better at flying than if we put a bat in a blender and turn it on and then look at how well that random arrangement of the same matter can fly. So in the self-organized structures that we see in non-equilibrium evolution, I think what we should be looking for is the pressure that this term is applying to the structure that emerges on some unknown fixed surface of reversal probability. And then we can still see here that the thing that forms in comparison to the thing we never see, what makes it likely is that the story of how it forms is that you have a lot of extra entropy production going on in all the different possible ways of getting there. Because the last thing that we can do to break this apart, and then I will release you from your prison, is that when I look at this cumulon generating function for the bath entropy production, I again can break it apart into the average entropy production and all the cumulants that give me the fluctuations, now over likely events that I might observe in the system. And what this is saying is that to be a likely outcome of this process, I want to do two things. I want to figure out as much as possible how to increase entropy production in my surroundings on average, and that's going to be by organizing in a way that gets the time-varying field to do a ton of work on me so that I can exhaust it into the surroundings. So we have a pressure to organize into structures that eat more energy from their surroundings. But also, we have a pressure to suppress fluctuations. We want to do that dissipation reliably. That if there are some ways of getting from one to two that are likely where you do a lot of dissipation and others where you do a little, then that kills you in this exponential averaging, even for likely events. But what you're really under pressure to become is a structure that reliably eats energy from its surroundings so that when you land in two, the story of how you got there is all the ways of getting there involved absorbing a lot of that work energy so that you could do a lot of dissipation. So what we see is a general physical pressure towards reliable work absorption and dissipation, which I have been trying to argue is a signature of adaptation, of which perhaps biological adaptation might be a special case. But I just threw that together really rapidly, so I don't expect you to buy it now. Maybe a few more of you might start to buy it this afternoon. At this point, I certainly should stop since I think I've run over time, but thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
In non-equilibrium thermodynamics, there has been a lot of hand waving for a long time over a principle of maximum entropy production, which would be somehow similar to the maximum entropy principle of equilibrium stat max, although now I will tell you how systems would behave. Think of what you just said as a sort of a justification for that idea of maximum entropy production as a driving force.
Yeah, good question. Okay, so I will answer that in by zooming out a little bit and referring to two different things that have been in circulation for a while, both of which I think get part of the issue but are not correct on their own, but that are special cases of this in some sense or capturing part but not all of what seems to be correct according to Newton's laws. One thing comes from Ilya Prigogine, the Nobel laureate in chemistry who got interested in entropy and biological organization a while ago, which is the idea that your driven non-equilibrium steady state near equilibrium. So if you're in a linear response regime, you can use the Onsager relations to show that your driven non-equilibrium steady state should be a condition where the rate of entropy production is minimal. So if you start away from your steady state, and as you relax to the steady state, you do always more entropy production on the way there than once you get there. So that is a condition of minimal dissipation, which people wondered might be some kind of way of, it's an optimization principle for arbitrary non-equilibrium evolution, but it turns out not to hold far from equilibrium, essentially because The near equilibrium regime is one where you can take this average of the exponential and turn it into the exponential of the average. And when you do that, this essentially becomes the Prigogine statement of the steady state being the condition of minimal entropy production. But in general, you can't take averages of exponentials and say that the same thing as the exponential of the average because of the strength of the fluctuations. So when you're arbitrarily far from equilibrium, the fluctuations have a non-trivial structure and it doesn't just behave Gaussianly. And so you can't do that. Your question is about a maximum entropy principle, which is a different kind of question, saying, can we use the idea of, you know, I'm in some phase space, there's some direction I could go in, I'm going to go in the direction that locally maximizes the rate of additional entropy production for my system. Is that a driving force that we can use to describe general non-equilibrium evolution? The reason, again, that that isn't, as I've just stated it, correct, is because of both of these terms. That first of all, you have to worry about kinetic accessibility. So if I have a glass of water on the table, one way of maximizing entropy production is to do nuclear fusion, right? Because then I'd release a ton of heat into the surroundings. And the reason that doesn't happen is because coming back from helium is really, really, really unlikely, right? So you have this kinetic inaccessibility term because of a huge activation barrier. And then there's also, again, this issue with fluctuations. You don't just care about the average entropy production. So I could draw two distributions for entropy production, you know, comparing these. So let's say I have one going from 1 to 2, my entropy production distribution looks like this, and going from 1 to 3 looks like that. I do want my average to be more positive, but if I can pull together the tightness of the distribution and make it so that the fluctuations are lower, this one with a lower average entropy production could win in terms of relative likelihood because it does a much more reliable entropy production on the way to where it's going. And in general, you always have to worry about these fluctuations because there are many cases where you can't just suppress them arbitrarily. So if it were as simple as saying there are a certain number of directions in phase space where fluctuations are essentially zero and we just worry about the average and then there a maximum entropy production principle would apply, that would be nice. But when you look at this relation, you can tell that's not true because suppose that 1 and 2 were both the same non-equilibrium steady state. So I just turn this into 1 and 1. Then this thing is just equal to 1, right? Because it's the ratio of something to itself. So we're back again with this thing of an average of an exponential being equal to 1. And what that's telling us is that the average rate of entropy production is going to be locked in with the strength of the fluctuation. So if I do more entropy production on average, I also increase my fluctuations. And the intuition there is just that doing more entropy production on average, if you can manage to do it without increasing the fluctuations, that means you're going somewhere new. Whereas if you're doing it in such a way that the fluctuations match the increase in entropy production, it essentially means you're doing a futile cycle and running around in circles. So the maximum entropy production principle, I think it's sort of the scent on the wind that it's catching is definitely in the right direction. But I think that only when you worry about the technical details of exactly how strong the fluctuations are and what is your surface of likely kinetically accessible outcomes on a given time scale, that's where you start to be able to say something that should hold exactly. And when it holds in a given system, I imagine it has to hold in cases where it so happens that those effects can be ignored, but one has to make that case carefully, I think.
So that principle captures the right idea for the first term of that equation there, but it's
not the equation
for the
right, exactly. So this would be the maximum entropy production principle, but then we have to worry about the fluctuations. And I also think the kinetic thing is very important, that in a given finite time, there are certain things, there are certain places in the phase space of the system that just are closer to where you're starting. And in any non-equilibrium scenario, we care about where we start. And that's less the case if we care about a non-equilibrium steady state, because then we lose our memory of where we start, presumably. But that's exactly the scenario in which I think the maximum entropy production principle becomes useless, because once we're in the steady state, the average rate of entropy production, it's simply not the case that you maximize the rate of entropy production when you reach a steady state. In fact, Near equilibrium, the opposite is the case. You minimize it. So in a particular case, I think, yeah, in particular cases, it might be. But I think then it starts to go into the details of the system that you're interested in. So I can, in a simple model, contrive a scenario in which I can see exactly why things work this way, because I can make a transition state diagram, or I can just think about Arrhenius-type kinetics, where suppose I have a state here that I start in, and I want to think about, am I going to go over here to the left, or am I going to go over here to the right? And so what I do is I say, I have the same activation barrier height here. So from Arrhenius kinetics, if it were just like this, I would have equal probability of hopping either way. And then we'll just make a wall here so that this is simple. And what we do is the following. Now when we start time varying a field, because to do dissipation, we have to do that, we time vary the field in such a way that when this state goes up, this transition state goes down. And when this state goes down, this transition state goes up. But then on this side, we drive this state so that when this transition state goes up, the state goes up. And when the transition state goes down, the state goes down. So what we do is we preserve delta E on this side. You'll allow my not drawing it very well to scale. And on this side, we just make it so that this state and that one don't get driven at all. Because what it means to time vary the Hamiltonian is that different microstates change their energies differently. So this is a general scenario, you know, where you could have microstates where it so happens that your applied field is modulating the energies of states in this way. The point of contriving the scenario in this way is that now if I land here versus if I land there, this is exactly the fixed surface of return probability, because in both cases, I have a jump of delta E to make in the reverse direction. But in the forward direction, I always have to jump over this barrier without its height changing at all. Whereas in this case, the difference between the energies of the transition state and this height gets smaller because of the way that these things are oscillating in tandem. And so what's generally going to happen then is I'm going to go over this way faster. I get a drift in that direction that comes from the fact that there's a specific tandem oscillation of the energies of these states. And when I do that, I have to dissipate a lot because I'll jump to the transition state, and then this state is down here, so I fall down there. And then I had work done on me by the applied field to get me up here. And then when I fall down the other side, I dissipate some of that work energy into the surrounding bath. So this is the scenario that at least gives you the intuition for why there is this coupling of drift in a certain direction to reliable dissipation on a surface of fixed return probability. When thinking about a specific system now, you have to say, what is your model of the rates of transitions between states, and where does that come from? I think maybe, and this is the thing that we're trying to work on now, but I don't have a very ironclad argument for it yet. I think maybe what might be true in a lot of many particle systems, which is promising, is that the return probability from a state may have a certain kind of self-averaging that happens, where there are a lot of different transitions that separately have to happen, where you're coming back the way you came, and the way that the applied field affects the way you come back is different than the way that it affected the way you went forward. These two things are going to be correlated because you're talking in many cases about some of the same states, and so it involves some of the same energies, but they won't be perfectly correlated. And so to the extent that the reverse probability becomes statistically uncorrelated from the forward probability, then maybe you can just say there is some very cheap way I can compute the return probability as though I draw it from a random distribution, and I don't have to necessarily compute it exactly in order to be confident of what it is. So we're trying to look at this in randomly disordered systems right now and see if we can see that. But yeah, I think it's in general, it's a hard problem because knowing any of these quantities exactly in principle involves detailed microscopic knowledge of all the different possible microtrajectories you could take. And the only way you can cheat is if the prediction you're looking for is not one where you say, I use this equation to predict a number that I then measure over here, but rather where I see this term as exerting a pressure that might allow me to make a prediction about a qualitative feature of the self-organized state that emerges. The one exception I know of this so far are cases where your model of the system already pretty tightly constrains the kinds of entropy production that can happen. So, for example, one of the things I haven't mentioned is that Darwinian natural selection pops right out of this in the special case where you consider self-replicators copying themselves. Because self-replication is something where the forward rate and the rate of it spontaneously undoing itself fixes a certain amount of entropy production that you have to do in your surroundings on average. And so if you assume that every time a self-replication event happens, you have some distribution of entropy production that's associated with that, then you can make the argument essentially that what is going to make a certain outcome more likely is going to be two things: the kinetic accessibility of a certain outcome having to do with the growth rate of the self-replicator, and how much entropy production is happening. And those two things together are what are going to, an alternate way of modeling the same system, they're going to look like your way of computing the Darwinian fitness of the system. So it's sort of, how well does this thing absorb energy from its surroundings and copy itself? So I don't know. I'm starting to ramble a little bit, so I should not go on. But the short answer is, I think it's very difficult to compute this quantity in a way where you can say, I know what number it should be. The question is whether, without doing that, there are still predictions that come out of this. Well, I'm saying that that is at least an example of a system where the model I would make of entropy production, it makes it a little more trivial because, you know, you could, for example, say, if every self-replication event, you don't want to worry about the statistical variation within the single event, you can treat each event like, you know, a process that looks the same every time it happens, then the amount of entropy production you do is going to be pegged to the number of self-replicators you have in your system in a pretty reliable way. So then the fluctuations about the average become less important. And also the kinetic accessibility is just a matter of computing things in certain Poisson processes. You can compute these probabilities. So you can show it's all consistent. I guess it's just in that case, you could argue, I don't really need the thermodynamics anyway. I just will do the calculation in the Poisson process. I already have a good stochastic model that I can use to compute all the statistics of what happens, so why do I care about thermodynamics? And I think that with the place where the thermodynamics becomes interesting is if it allows us to cheat in some sense, where we don't know enough about the detailed stochastic model, but because of the thermodynamic intuition, we can still make accurate predictions about things that have to hold for the self-organized outcome without having a full account of how it got there. Sort of like how, you know, when you look in the Darwinian sense, if I have something that lives in an ocean, in some sense it has to be adapted to that, right? That it has to be able to breathe there or swim there. And once I make certain assumptions about what it has to be able to do to persist and survive there, then I can somehow constrain the space of possibilities. I may not know whether it has fins or whether it has, you know, little cilia, because that could depend on the size. So I can't fully constrain the space of outcomes, but maybe I can make predictions on the surface of possible outcomes that would distinguish it at least from things that have no chance of surviving in an ocean, like a cow, for example.
Do you have any more questions?
Thank you.